We're holding Parshat Shoftim, and we're going to try to run through the parsha and then review it with more depth. We're limited in time tonight, so I don't know how much we'll get to go through the whole parsha in depth, but we'll try. The parsha begins with Shoftim v'Shotrim, the commandment to establish judges and policemen, which needs better definition. What is a Jewish policeman? And the commandment for the judges to be just and be very careful with the letter of the law, because we know one of the preconditions to having the land is keeping the law, as the Navi Isaiah told us. We read this a few weeks ago. Tzion v'mishpat tipadev shaveh b'tzedakah. The redemption of Zion is through justice. We have a commandment not to establish a tree called an Asherah tree, which is some kind of tree that was used for idol worship. We'll expand on that later. Or to establish a special rock that was also used for idol worship, called the Matzeva. We're not allowed to bring sacrifice before Hashem that has a blemish. And the Torah tells us if we find a Jew, male or female, that serves idols, so then we have to check out the witnesses carefully, and if their testimony is true, then that person is put to death, assuming all the preconditions were met, he was forewarned, etc. What happens if we have a doubt how we should rule on some kind of ruling? So the Torah tells us we go to the high court in Jerusalem. Here we have the highest court, the Sanhedrin, that was sitting in the Lishkat HaGazit, and we must obey what they say. And herein we have the commandment to obey what our sages say, and the source for the mitzvot Rabbanan. The rabbinic mitzvot are here in our parsha. If one does not want to listen to what they say, he is going to get the death penalty, and this is the laws of Zaken Mamre, an elder who rebels against the high court. And we've hit Cheney. When we come to the land, the Torah tells us that we may want to establish a king, and we have a mitzvah to establish a king with all the mitzvahs that the king has. Three mitzvahs the king has: not to have too many horses, too many wives, and not to have too much gold and silver. He has a positive mitzvah to write an extra Sefer Torah that will be with him all the time, and he is given a special warning to be a humble person, to serve Hashem, and we're told that if he goes in these ways, then his kingdom will continue for him and his offsprings. Here we see that the Torah supports a dynasty, that the kingdom is supposed to go from father to son, and we've hit Shlishi. The Torah tells us a special commandment that the Kohanim and Levim do not have a section in the land or the booty. Their section is what God gives them. And here the Torah gives them another gift, the front right arm of the animals that are slaughtered, and the cheek with the tongue, and part of the intestines, part of the stomach. We're also reminded to give them the truma, first of our grains, and here we have another commandment to give them reshit hagez, the first shearings of our sheep. We've hit revi. A Levi has a special mitzvah whenever he wants, he could join in the singing in the Beit HaMikdash, and a Kohen in the regalim on the special festive occasions is allowed to partake of the different sacrifices. Even though ordinarily the Kohanim were divided into different watchings and each one had a set week, here the Torah tells us that on the festivals everyone's allowed to partake of the korbanos. Hashem tells us don't learn from the nations when you enter the land. Let's leave it for their view. And the Torah here gives a lot of specifications. Don't go in their ways of all kinds of witchcraft. The Torah enumerates many. The Torah says, God finds that disgusting, and because of that he kicked out the nations from the land. Tamim tiyem Hashem nokecha. You should be whole and complete with Hashem your God, and we fit chamishi. These nations, they do go to listen to all these different types of witchcrafts and people who can tell the future, but Hashem tells you you're going to have a prophet. And here the Torah introduces that God will establish a prophet like Moshe, and we have to listen to him with all the specifications that he has to tell the truth. He has to be a truthful prophet. If we don't listen to him when he tells us a prophecy from Hashem, the person is chayav the death penalty. A prophet who prophesies something that Hashem didn't say, or he says in the name of another god, that prophet gets killed. And how do we know if a prophet's lying, says the Torah, if he tells us something that doesn't come true, so we know he's lying. And here we went into great detail last week as to how we really test the Navi. Hashem says, don't fear the Navi. If he tells you something that doesn't come true, you know he's lying, do not be scared of him. Chapter 19. Hashem says, when we enter the land of Israel and we conquer the land, we have to set aside three cities of refuge, three Arei Miklat, and put road signs so that people know how to find the way. And here the Torah goes into the details of who goes to these cities of refuge? Who gets to stay in them? The person who mistakenly kills someone and the relatives want to kill him, he could run to these cities of refuge. We're supposed to set aside three. We're supposed to divide the land into three or four sections. We'll discuss that, how we divide the land. And they are going to the cities of refuge. What happens if Hashem expands the land? And here we're introduced to the concept that we could expand the land. And, says the Rambam, this never came true. We never got to expand the land beyond the boundaries. David HaMelech conquered a little bit more land, but not to the extent that the Torah describes that we will be able to have three more cities of refuge. Says the Rambam, why does the Torah give us a whole parsha? Hashem knows what's going to be in the future. Hashem says, if you will expand the land, then you'll have another three cities of refuge. Well, it never happened. So what's the Torah telling us? Says the Rambam, it's still going to happen. We have a tradition that this parsha is talking about Yemos HaMashiach. Says the Rambam, this is one of the sources that we are still Hashem's chosen people, because Hashem gave us a parsha in the Torah that never had any relevance. God doesn't speak for nothing. If God said it, then obviously it's going to happen. Hasn't yet happened. So that means there's still going to be a time when we will be in the land and expand our ownership over the land of Israel to include an area where we will establish another three cities of refuge. This is a Rambam, one of the letters. If a person kills his friend willfully and he thinks he'll get away with it by running to the cities of refuge, Torah says take him out of there, don't let him stay there, and don't have extra compassion on him. You have to wipe out, get rid of the clean blood that was spilled, and this is how it'll be good for you. We've hit shishi. Torah says, "Lo tasig gvul re'acha." One may not try to overtake boundaries, and this, our sages said, includes also unfair business competition. I don't think we'll get to this today to expand on this. But, if you're in a different city and someone, you go and open a pizza shop in another city where there's already a pizza shop, so that's not fair. The Torah limits how much we could compete with one another. Obviously, if we're both dwelling in the same city, just like he could open a pizza shop, I could open a pizza shop. But from a different city, so all these details aren't for now. We're not allowed to accept the testimony of one witness. We accept testimony if it's said by two or three witnesses. And again, the courts have to check out these witnesses that they're telling the truth. The Torah introduces the laws of Edim Zomimim, a special law about witnesses who lie and get caught in their lie. And the Torah says if certain conditions are met, then these witnesses get the same punishment they wanted to inflict upon the person they were testifying about. When we go to war, if we're going to war just to expand our boundaries, a milchem toshut, so then certain people are allowed to leave the war. If someone built a house, he didn't get to live in it. Person got engaged, he didn't get to live with his wife, he hasn't had a full year. Person planted as a vineyard, he hasn't yet had a year. So these people are allowed to go back, or any person that's scared. If we have a milchemet mitzvah, a milchama that's part of the mitzvah of conquering the land of Israel or protecting the Jews from an enemy, so there we say, afilu chatan mechadro v'kalam chupata, even a chasen from the room, we say, hey, there's a war, you gotta go. So the Torah tells us towards the end of the parasha that we establish a special kohen that's called kohen mashuach milchama, and he speaks to the people, he tells them, you're going to war, don't be scared. Here the Torah prohibits us to be scared. Just like we're not allowed to eat chazer, we're not allowed to be scared at a time of war. It's a biblical prohibition. One is forbidden to be scared at a time of war. Hashem is going with you. Don't be scared of the enemies. And we establish again policemen, shotrim, who command the nation and guide them. We've hit shvi. When we go to war, the Torah says, first thing is we offer them peace. If they want peace, then they have to accept the sheva mitzvos bnei noach, and then they have to pay taxes and be subservient. If they go to war, so we place siege on the city and we conquer it. And the Torah goes into details what we do when we conquer it. What is the difference between the seven nations and the other nations? And here there's a great discussion. Do we offer the seven nations peace or not? The Torah tells us a special commandment of Baal Tashchis in our parasha. Not to destroy trees that are fruit-bearing trees. And this is the source of Baal Tashchis, that we're not supposed to destroy things that have potential. Again, if there's a need for it, you're allowed to do it. If a person has a special need, he has benefit, he has animals that are damaging his property, he's allowed to kill them. If his own animals are better, are worth more dead than alive, he's allowed to kill them, etc. The Torah ends our parasha with the story of a person, what happens if a person is found dead, and we know he was murdered, but we don't know who killed him, and he's found dead outside the city, so we have a special mitzvah, we do research, we try to find out who killed him. And when we can't find out who killed him, so the Torah says we do a special procession of Egla Arufa. We bring sages from Jerusalem. We bring, we measure to see which city is the closest city, and that city has to give a special young calf, which is brought to a river, and by the river bank, we hack off its head from the neck, and that area is supposed to remain barren forever. Whoever's field that was in, he's got a problem. That area of the field, that's all prohibited. He can never plant it again. And the Torah says, this is a way of, on the one hand, Hashem says, we ask Hashem, forgive us. We did our best. We researched. We tried to bring justice to the world. And Hashem says, you do this procession. This shows that you took heed. You noticed what happened. You didn't let it just happen. A person gets murdered and you ignore it. You say, okay, a person got murdered. No one knows who he is. No one knows who the murderer is. What can we do? No, you did what you could. And Hashem says, I'll forgive you. What do we need forgiveness for? Well, if something bad happens in our neighborhood, then that shows something about us as well. Now let's review the parsha with more depth. In our parsha, we noticed, as we ran through it, we are given guidance as to the guiding bodies of the Jewish people. We have Shoftim, the judges. That's number one. That's the rabbis. That's the Sanhedrin. We have the king, special mitzvahs of appointing a king. And we have the prophet, special mitzvahs of how we accept the true prophet, how we have to listen to him. And we have the Kohanim. The Kohanim are leading the people. Shoftim, we know the highest court was the Sanhedrin. The word Sanhedrin is a Greek word which means wise men. Sanhedrin means the wise men. We have a mitzvah to establish courts, and we have a specific mitzvah to establish a court in each tribe. There was the high court, like you have a state supreme court and the United States Supreme Court, Lahavdil, right? So each state has its supreme court, and then there's a chief governing body, the United States Supreme Court. So they got this idea from somewhere. And the Torah says, every Shevet has to have a supreme court. Every Shevet has a high court. And above all of them is the highest court that was sitting in the base of Mikdash and the Lishka Sagazis. That's the Sanhedrin. Now, under them, we have courts for each city. And you had more courts. You had courts of 23 men, courts of 3 men. There were many courts. But the Torah tells us we have to establish a court in each city and a high court in each Shevet. And above them, the highest court in the Lishka Sagazis. That's a general question. Why are sages adopted Greek words into the Mishnah and the Gemara? I don't know. I don't know why. The Torah tells us that we have to establish a court and we have to establish shotrim. Shotrim, so to speak, are policemen. They have whips and sticks and they say, this is what the court says, you have to listen. They're the enforcers of the law. But in Halacha, the Rambam says that there's more to it than that. The policemen had a job to circle through the marketplaces, the different stores, and to check that people weren't cheating on the scales, check that people weren't transgressing. That was the court's jobs. That was the policeman's jobs. And certain things, if they caught you doing it, they'd beat you up. And certain things, if they caught you doing it, they'd bring you to court. So what are these? Ruffians? People who, they're big men who carry a big stick? So no, these men, you'd have 3 men walking around town, and there were 3 men who had to be Talmidei Chachamim. They really were courts. They were mobile courts. The policemen were really 3 men who would walk around and had the power of a court, and those were the shotrim. The policemen were people who themselves were learned, and they could enforce what the law says. Now, sometimes they'd say, this is something that our job is to hit a person for. We catch you trying to cheat people, using false coins, whatever. So that maybe they would beat for. And other things, they'd say, this is terrible. The courts have to judge over this, and they'd bring the person to court. But the shotrim weren't just a bunch of rough people who could carry a big stick and beat people up. Torah says we have to establish judges and shotrim and policemen that will police the enforcing of the Torah. This mitzvah of Sanhedrin is really only in Eretz Yisrael. The mitzvah of establishing a high court. And in order to have a court, we really have to have people who are musmach. What is smicha? It means that he was ordained as a rabbi for the courts by someone who was ordained, all the way back to Moshe Rabbeinu. We don't have that anymore. So there's a long discussion and there are great limitations imposed because our rabbis don't have smicha that goes back to Moshe Rabbeinu. We don't have that. So what right do we have to judge? So that, the first siman in Choshen Mishpat, the Torah, the Shulchan Aruch, goes back to the Gemara. The Gemara discusses, how did they judge in Bavel? How do you have courts in Bavel? The courts, we're told in our parsha, there's a mitzvah to establish courts in the land of Israel. Well then, by what right do we have courts in Chutz Laretz? So the Gemara goes into that, and we're given special permission by the high courts to rule, and we're very limited in what we may rule, even in the land of Israel today, because our rabbis don't have real smicha. We don't have that continuum. That continuum ended. The Torah tells us we have to be careful not to recognize faces in court, not to treat people with extra honor. Everyone has to be treated fairly. There is certain honor that is given to Talmud Chacham and the Talmud Chacham's wife. Here we have the concept, Eshet Chaver Arei Kechaver. The wife of a Chaver gets the same honor as a Chaver. The Gemara says that if a wife of a Talmud Chacham walks into court, the rabbis have to stand just like if he himself walked into court. She's owed the same honor. She's a partner in his Torah. The Torah tells us we're not allowed to take a bribe. A bribe, the Torah forewarns us, blinds the wise and messes up the words of the tzaddikim. Even if a person is a complete tzaddik, the Torah tells him, you should know there's no way that you'll get a bribe and it won't affect you. Person can't think, I'm okay, it didn't affect me. Says the Torah, no. Even if you think you're okay, the Torah says it's not okay. The Torah tells us we have to chase after justice. From here we derive that a person has to look for a kosher court. It's one of the mitzvahs we have. When we have a court case, we have to look for a kosher court. The Torah says, Lo tita lacha ashera. Don't plant an asherah tree. What's an asherah tree? So we discussed that one understanding is that an asherah tree is a tree that was served, or a tree that under the tree they put an idol, then they served the idol that was under the tree. The Ramban says something interesting here. He says an Asherah wasn't really a tree that was served. An Asherah was a tree that they'd plant so that everyone could see where the house of worshipping idols was. So they'd plant this extra high tree and everyone could see that, and that was a sign. This is where we go worship. The Torah tells us don't establish a matzeva. What's a matzeva? A matzeva is one stone that was used to worship, to bring sacrifices on. Now, we know that Avraham Avinu, when he brought sacrifices, he brought them on a matzeva. Yitzchak brought on a matzeva. Yaakov brought on a matzeva. All the forefathers brought their sacrifices on one big stone, on a matzeva. That was the accepted practice, how you served God. So what changed? How come suddenly here, after 40 years in the desert, God says, that disgusts me?
Rashi said now he chose a spot. That's supposed to be the spot now.
Oh, so that's what you're saying was in last week's parsha. It's a different aspect, that once we have the Beis HaMikdash, we have to serve in the Beis HaMikdash. But there were times when we could bring on private altars, and even then, the Torah says we can't use one stone, because once the nations of the land started using this one stone formula for serving idols, so God says, now it's disgusting in my eyes. It became a Canaanite thing, right. So this applies to different halachos. When do we apply this, when we don't? That deserves a separate class. But an example of where it's applied is we find in Tanakh that people used to pray very often with their hands open up to Shamayim, that raise their hands. And we don't find that that's brought anywhere that we could continue doing that. So the Chassam Sofer says, in the time of the Tanakh, it was still something that was positive. That was a way of prayer, or raising your hands up to the heavens. And then the nation started using it for their service. So that became disgusting. And therefore, one should not pray with raising his hands like this, open hands.
That's a specific thing. We're not supposed to pray.
That's a specific thing, yeah. The Chassam Sofer says that in Shulchan Aruch. That became disgusting before Hashem. That's his opinion. The Sephardim, I don't know if he knew of the Sephardi custom. The Sephardim have the custom that in benching, when they say Poseach Sedecha, they open their own hands. So to speak, Hashem is giving it into my hands. Poseach Sedecha, Mespeach Chacharitzom. But that's not the same thing. So over here the Torah says, don't establish one stone. Hashem hates that. Again, the Ramban has another understanding. What's a matzeva? The Ramban says the matzeva is this huge stone they'd establish that the priest could stand on to expound to the people. They'd establish a huge stone at the entrance to their temples, and the priest would stand on that stone lecturing. Hashem says, I don't want a matzeva, don't do anything like that by the Beis HaMikdash. So from here we derive that one is not allowed to plant any tree on Har Habayis. One is not allowed to establish any stones, even though we have in the Tanakh, it's recorded that they did have all kinds of shadings in the Beis HaMikdash. Everything was made of stone. They never had a tree for shade. We know that they had a itztevak fula, like like double, it was two sets of canopies in the base surrounding Har HaBayis, and the canopies were all stone. They didn't have any trees in Har HaBayis because you couldn't plant the tree in Har HaBayis. Does that mean you're not allowed to have a tree that came on its own? Do we have to uproot the trees that are there? It doesn't say you have to uproot. It says you're not allowed to plant a tree there. But again, this deserves more depth.
What does that mean that, like, if the goyim steal one of our customs, then all of a sudden we can't do it anymore?
So
what about mikvah? They do baptizing.
So that's a... Two things. We're confusing mitzvah d'oraisa, mikvah it says in the Torah, with other things. Mitzvah d'oraisa doesn't change just because they started doing it. And when we do apply it, deserves a class in and unto itself. When do we apply it? Do we apply it to any minik? They wear shirts, so we won't wear shirts. So we don't say that. So when do we say that? Okay.
Where is that discussed?
I don't know of any specific place. It's
the kind of things we stopped doing because the going started?
There are guidelines. There are Tosas in that discuss it. I don't know of a place that there's one conclusive place. It's in many places it's discussed.
Do we even have that today? Like, we can't really declare that nowadays, right?
I'm not sure. No. A lot of the discussions that you'll find in the Chasam Sofer and others regarding the Reform movement will bring this point, that the Reform movement tried to introduce into our synagogues things that you don't have a specific halacha that says are forbidden, but they were trying to introduce things that they were taking from the Christian church. And there, if you want to see a lot of discussion on that, a lot of the tshuvas that were written regarding the Reform and conservative are going to bring this point. They're trying to introduce something which is disgusting into a shul because it's something that is used by other religions. It doesn't say anywhere specifically you can't do A, B, or C.
It's different than saying something that used to be armed and how now we're going to stop.
Okay, right. So on that also you have to see. A lot of the tshuvas also regarding Shabtai Tzvi have the same issue. But I'll tell you the truth, we have only half hour left and a lot to cover. So, sorry. We've got to continue. Torah says if we find a man or a woman who starts serving idols. And it's interesting to note that whenever it comes to hanky-panky, going to idols or going to witchcraft, Torah speaks about women. Most of the mitzvahs, we say women are obligated like men. Any mitzvah Torah says women are equal to men. We have exceptions, but usually they're included. Suddenly, when it comes to witchcraft, we're talking about mechashefa. Here the Torah says about serving idol worship, isho isha. When we get to later on, the Torah says about going to seek out all the kinds of magicians. Again, we speak about women. So the Rambam says, in Mor Nevuchim, that, and the Ramban in our Pasha says the same thought, that women have a tendency to want to be more willing to believe things that are illogical. You'll find a lot of the people working with all kinds of the alternative medicine are women. I think they outnumber men maybe 10 to 1 in alternative medicine. Definitely, if when you go and see the lines, people who go for alternative medicine, you see that they outnumber, women outnumber men 10 to 1. I've been there. That's what I've seen. So I was a man who was there, it's true. And I don't think that all alternative medicine is ridiculous. But certainly things that don't have logical founding, women are willing to follow more easily than men. And this was certainly true throughout history where most women were illiterate. Women's education today, we look at a woman and a woman could read, she could write. You go back 100 years, 150 years, that wasn't the case anywhere. A woman who could read and write was the exception, so certainly she's going to be more easily enticed by things that defy logic, because how much logic does she know? She knows how to run a house well, but if you're keeping women ignorant and you're not teaching them anything, so then what's the difference to them if it's a doctor or a witch doctor? They haven't learned much logic, and that was the world. They say that Rabbi Akiva Eiger's wife didn't know how to read or write, which isn't surprising. Many women didn't know how to read and write. But whether this is something intrinsic in women's tendencies or this is something that came from women's status in society, I don't know. At any rate, we find that the Torah, when it comes to discussing Avodah Zarah and going to witch doctors and going to all kinds of people who can, so to speak, tell you what's going to be in the future, the Torah lists women because they have two things. One, they're more easily deceived. That's That's something which we see throughout. You read fables or folklore. The woman is always the one that's deceived. There are also men deceived, but they have many, many stories revolving around that. And number two, says the Rambam, because women always want the benefit of their family. And they're willing to do anything to ensure the security of their family. And the priests for idol worship at that time would tell the women, if you don't pass your son through this fire, he's going to die, he's going to be damaged. And the woman's scared. She wants her kid to have the best. So what does she care? So we'll do this. The Torah says in our parasha, don't let your son be passed through the fires of the Molech. Now, there are two opinions in the Gemara and Sanhedrin, whether the child was scorched, was he burnt to death when they passed him through these fires, or did he come out alive? Maybe they didn't really pass him through. So if he came out alive, that's easily understood. They're telling him, what's wrong? We'll pass him in between two fires, he won't get hurt. And we're telling you, if you do that, he'll live a long life. If you don't do that, you know what could happen to him? So the women would be scared of this. The Rambam says even in his time, it was common that the midwives, when a child was born, they'd have special incense they'd put on the fire, and they'd tell the mother, you want the child to live a long life, we have to pass him through the smoke, around the smoke. And the Rambam says that in his opinion, this is clear that this is molech, passing the child through the smoke of the incense over the fire. So the Rambam says that's molech. And the Rambam says because of these two reasons, the Torah enumerates men and women when it comes to the prohibition of Avod Zar in the beginning of the parasha, the prohibition of Molech later on, or the prohibition of going to different kinds of people who want to foretell the future in the middle of the parasha.
Or were leaders do mock sacrifices to Molech right now?
Tell you what, we'll talk about it, but we have a short time, so let's not talk about it now, okay? I don't know about it. I'd like to hear about it, but now we're very limited on time, so we got to run forward. Sorry. Okay, thank you. The Torah tells us that if we have witnesses walking into court and telling us that someone served idols, so we have to check it out and check out if it's true. Whether they're two witnesses or three witnesses, we accept their witness, their testimony, but we do not accept one witness. So the obvious question is, why does the Torah have to enumerate three? If we believe two, obviously we believe three. And here our sages say the Torah enumerated two and three to teach us that two are equal to three. And this is a special concept in halacha, that when it comes to testimony, if you have 100 people walking in and they're one group of witnesses, they say, we were all at the stadium, we were all standing together, and we saw Joe get up to kill Mac. Okay? So we're all witnesses, we're all together. And Joe was standing there, and the umpire called out, I said, don't kill him, so he struck you out, don't kill him. And Joe said, no, I'm going to kill him. He picked up a knife and went to kill Mac. So all these witnesses, that you have 100 people saying it happened. Says the Torah, those 100 people, they're one group of witnesses. Let's say two witnesses walk into court, and they say, guys, you're all liars. At that hour that you're saying that happened, we were with Joe in Afghanistan. We were serving together. Joe was with us. He couldn't have killed anyone. He was out in Afghanistan. He wasn't at Chase Stadium. So we have a contradiction. So you'd say 100 over 2. Believe the 100. Says the Torah, no. Once you have a set of witnesses, that's one set. I don't care if that set has 2, 100, 1,000, 1,000,000. Doesn't matter how many people were at the stadium. They're all together. And again, we have to discuss in detail a different time what makes them one group or what makes them not one group. But assuming they're all one group, they're all standing together, they all see one another, they all see the murder, the Torah says, well, you have two saying that Joe is out in Afghanistan. You have 100, that's really one group of witnesses, one testimony of 100 that's saying he was there and he did the murder. So you have a contradiction. We can't do anything. We have a contradiction. Two can contradict 100, assuming they're one group. Now this is a klal when it comes to edut, to testimony. In ne'emanut, that's a different concept in halacha, there we say we're interested in as many opinions and more opinions have greater weight. What's an example of ne'emanut? Your wife has ne'emanut. A woman cannot testify. A woman is not a kosher aid, but a woman can tell you that food's kosher. How can you tell me that food's kosher? You're serving me food. Your wife is going to give you food. How do you know the food is kosher? She says it's kosher. You believe her. Why do you believe her? She's not kosher as a witness, because it's not a question of testimony. It's a question of ne'emanut. That's a different concept. Different concept in halacha. Testimony is a special thing in court. In your house, when someone tells you it's kosher, that's ne'emanut. Do you believe him? You believe him. He's telling you it's kosher. Ne'emanut, a woman also has. Ne'emanut, when it comes to belief, there, 100 has more weight than 2. 3 have more weight than 2. When it comes to ne'emanut, when it's something, how much do I believe him? So then obviously I believe 100 more than I believe 2. When it comes to Eidut, when it comes to testimony, there we say no. Two are equal to 100, doesn't matter. They're one group, they're one testimony. The Torah tells us that the witnesses are the first to administer the death penalty, and this is true for all four types of death penalties. The witnesses have to take hand. And think about it psychologically. It's very easy to testify, and then the court executes the person. The Torah tells us the witnesses here have to execute. They're the ones claiming this man had forewarning. He did it willfully. This is the person that did it. We know all the details necessary to kill him. Says the Torah, okay. If the courts can decide that he gets the death penalty, then you're the first people who administer the death penalty. What happens if we don't know what the halacha is? So the Torah says we go to the high court and we have to listen to the high court. We have a special mitzvah to listen to Sanhedrin. Now, we discussed that there are different powers in the Jewish people. And the first power our Torah discusses is the power of the courts. The power of the courts, ordinarily, we tend to think of as lightly, because we know that when we have a safek, we're in doubt what the halacha is. So I say, safekat rabbanan nekula, a doubt in a rabbinic ruling, so there we could be more lenient. A doubt in something that's a mitzvah d'oraita, a biblical ruling, there we have to be more stringent. We have a rule when it comes to rabbinic rulings that there are other leniencies. We don't have time to go into them. So we know there are leniencies when it comes to rabbinic rulings. On the other hand, the Torah here tells us we have to listen to the rabbis. So it seems like there's a biblical commandment to fulfill the rabbinic rulings. That means whenever I'm doing a mitzvah d'rabbanan, whenever I'm doing a rabbinic ruling, I might be in performance of at least one biblical mitzvah. The Torah says you have to listen to them. Don't not listen to them. So we have a mitzvah say, a mitzvah lo say. It could be that every time I'm performing a rabbinic ruling, I'm performing two Torah rulings. So then how could I be lenient when I have a doubt on a rabbinic ruling? It automatically includes two mitzvahs or one mitzvah d'oraisa. So this concept is a big machlokas among the Rishonim. Does every mitzvah d'rabbanan include one, two, three mitzvahs d'oraisa? And there are obvious questions, like the one we just enumerated, and there are obvious answers. For example, you could say that the rabbis instituted, part of their institution was that whenever you have a doubt in one of their mitzvot, so be more lenient. That's one answer that's given. That maybe that's part of their institution. So when you have a doubt, when you have a safek, you could be more lenient. Because that was part of their institution, that you do this, and when you have a doubt, be more lenient. There are other answers. So Torah tells us we have to obey the high court, the mitzvot of the Sanhedrin, the mitzvot of the Bet and the Shkat HaGazit. Now, only they are given this extreme power to institute mitzvot, and to that whatever they say, we have to listen to them. Ordinarily, you have to listen to the rabbi, you ask him a question, he tells the halacha, you have to listen to him, but he doesn't have the power that the high court has. Only they have these specific powers of making institutions for all of the Jewish people. And there's a logical reason they should have it, because otherwise there's no religion. The courts in this part of the world are going to rule this way, the courts over there are going to rule that way, and everyone's doing their own thing. So there's one central body that runs the show, and that's the court and the Lishkat HaGazit. We no longer have that central body. We no longer have courts in general. Our courts are very limited, as we discussed. We have to listen to them. We know that there was a time that the courts under Rabban Gamliel ruled that the month of Tishrei, begins on a specific day. They decided that that month would not be a month of 30 days. It would be a month of 29 days. And Rabbi Yeshua, who was much older than Rabban Gamliel, bigger Talmud Chacham, it seems very clearly from the story, and one who had been from the generations of his grandfather, one who learned from his Rebbeim, he was Mamash's Rebbe. He knew more than Rabban Gamliel. He knew more than the head of the court. He ruled, he understood, he didn't go and rule that, but he understood that really the month should be a month of 30 days. And comes Rosh Hashanah, okay, do what you want, but Yom Kippur is coming up. So from when do you count 10 days to Yom Kippur? So Rabbi Gamliel says, you count from the first day of Rosh Chodesh, because there were only 29 days till last month. Rabbi Gamliel says, no. Rabbi Gamliel says, you count from the first day, because there were 29 days in last month. And Rabbi Yeshua says, that's wrong. So Rabbi Gamliel, who's a young Nasi, he's young, he's the head of the courts, sends word to Rabbi Yeshua, who's an old man already, tells him, on Yom Kippur, that comes out according to the way you calculate Yom Kippur, you have to come before me with your stick, and your money belt, you have to come before me, showing the nation that it's a weekday. Everyone has to see you doing milacha on Yom Kippur, that according to your calculation. Rabbi Yehoshua was willing to fast 2 days straight. He was going to respect Rabbi Gamliel's ruling and fast on the day that he felt was right. Rabbi Gamliel says, can't do that. So Rabbi Yehoshua was upset. Until his disciple, Rabbi Akiva, was Rabbi Yehoshua's disciple, told him no. He showed him from the Torah, we have to do what he says. Whatever the court says, we have to listen. And Rabbi Gamliel listened to him. Rabbi Yehoshua listened to him. Rabbi Yehoshua took his stick, he took his money, and he went to Rabbi Gamliel on the day that he held was Yom Kippur. And Rabbi Gamliel got up from his seat, he kissed him on the head, and he blessed him, Rabbi v'talmidi. He said, Rabbi, you're for sure smarter than me. You're my Rabbi. You're a bigger Talmud Chacham. But Talmidi that you accepted, that I'm the head of the court and what I say goes. The Gemara explains that Rabbi Gamliel had a tradition that he had from his forefathers that this was the way to decide the new month. He had a tradition Rabbi Yehoshua was unaware of. And that's why Rabbi Gamliel was allowed to do what he did. And he was right and everyone accepted his ruling. But we have a mitzvah to listen to the high courts. And if there's an elder who is not willing to listen to the courts, so in his own city, disagrees with everyone. And he goes to the court of the Shevet and he tells him, you're wrong. And they say, who knows, you're a big tam-tam, let's go to the high court. We go up to Jerusalem, they go up to the high court in Jerusalem. Till they get to Jerusalem, anyone who has some halacha, he rules his own way. They get to the high court in Jerusalem, and in the Lishkas Agazis, the high court rules against him. So it could be that there were 30 people in the high court who agreed with him. But at the end of the day, most of the high court didn't agree with him, and the ruling is not like him. Says the Torah, if he goes back to his city, and this is a question which is a doraisa, if it's a doraisa question, and there are more limitations, we're not going into that. And he's asked the question, and he again rules, like his own ruling, then he's taken up to Jerusalem, and he's put to death, even though he's a big tzaddik, and a big tam-tam, could be he's the second one in the court, in the high court. Could be he's number two. Could be there's only one person better than him in the whole country. So he's a big person, big tam-tam, but still, says the Torah, if he'll rule against the high court, he'll be put to death. That's the halacha of zaken mamre, an elder who is mamre, who is rebelling, he's going against the high court. This shows us that even a big talmid chacham has to be under the high court, what they says he has to do. And we have four people that the Torah tells us are put to death publicly, that we wait for the regel, for the holidays, when everyone gathers in Jerusalem to put them to death. And they are zaken mamre, ben sorer umore, the rebellious son, mesit, someone who tries to convince other people to serve idols, and I don't remember the fourth. Who's the fourth? I don't remember. The fourth is Edim Zomimim. What we'll see at the end of the parsha.
What was it called? The Lishkat?
Hagazit.
What?
Hagazit.
Lishkat Hagazit?
Yeah, Hagazit is a type of stone.
Okay, but Lishkat, that's like the source of the word that we call Lishkat.
Lishkat is a room, yeah. We have many rooms are called the Shachot in the Beit HaMikdash.
What's the fourth?
Edim Zomimim. Special witnesses that we'll discuss at the end of the parsha if we get there. The Medrash says as follows, when it comes to the words of the rabbis, Chavivin divrei sofrim divrei nevuah. The words of the rabbis are more stringent, they are more beloved than the words of the prophets. And the Medrash gives us a mashal. Medrash says, let's say a king comes to a city and he tells them, I want you to know, I have over here my officer. Whenever he tells you something I said and he gives you a signed document from me, listen to what he says. So that's one level. Then you could have a king that tells about a different officer. He says, this officer, whatever he says, even if he doesn't bring my signed documents, whatever he says, listen to him. That's obviously a much higher level. The Torah says, a prophet comes and tells us something, he has to give us a sign that God sent him. The prophet walks in, he says, God said, tomorrow you all should stand on your head. You say, okay, sounds nice, but prove you're a prophet first. You have to prove that you have the signature of the king. If our sages tell us, tomorrow, all of you have to stand on your heads. We'll have to listen. They told us. Our sages have more strength than a prophet, to an extent. There's a Mishnah, the Gemara in Sanhedrin enumerates, that there are aspects that the words of our sages are even more stringent than the words of the Torah. Now, the Torah tells us we have to listen to our sages, and this is the source, we said, for all mitzvot Rabbanan. Torah tells us when we come to the land, we inherit it. And then we'll say to ourselves, let's have a king. So then we have a mitzvah to establish a king. So then why was Hashem upset when we asked for a king?
Because we wanted a king like all the other nations.
We came and said we want to be like all the nations, and in truth, Hashem says over there in Sefer Shmuel, Hashem says really they're just disgusted with you, Shmuel. They're trying to find an excuse to bump you off. You could keep guiding them, but they don't want you. And you're the prophet who's supposed to be leading them. That's why Hashem was upset. Really, we have a mitzvah to establish a king. And the Torah tells us that we should establish a king, Asher Yivcha Hashem Elokecha Bo, that Hashem chooses him. So if we look in the Rambam, when he quotes these halachas, so the Rambam says, we establish a king. The king has to be established based on the high court of 70 elders, and the Navi says, just as you have to establish a king, like Hashem commands you. But the Ramban has a fascinating understanding here. The Ramban says that when the Torah says you'll establish a king that Hashem chooses, the Torah is just foreshadowing. The Torah is telling you, you'll choose a king. And you should know that afterwards you might tell yourself, shucks, why did we choose him? You should know, if you chose him, at the end of the day, that must be the person Hashem wanted for that period. Doesn't mean you have to keep him. But whoever's king, you should know, God guides us in our decision on who's king. The Ramban says the same understanding is true when the Torah says, the place that Hashem chooses, that's where you'll erect the house of worship to Hashem. So the Ramban again says this amazing idea. He says, it means you'll choose among your tribes. You'll decide on a place. And you'll say, that place is fitting. After you've chosen a place, you should know God had a hand in helping you make that decision. Not necessarily a seen hand. Not that the prophet walks in and says, this is the person who's supposed to be king, or this is the place that Hashem wants. But rather, after you've chosen, you should know Hashem helped you get there. That's how the Ramban understands this. Pasuk says this is his own pshat, but he says this is what he thinks is right.
If the problem was, the commandment is like, it says here that you should, Allah melech kechol goyim.
Oh. So that's why I didn't want to argue with what you said. So the Ramban says that this is an allusion to what would happen later. That they would really want one. The Torah is alluding to what would really happen. The Torah isn't saying you should say this. You'll come, you'll inherit, you'll settle in the land, right. And you'll say, I want a king like all the nations. You do have a mitzvah to establish a king, but you shouldn't really be saying, I want to be like all the nations. That's one understanding, but there's an expansion over here among the Mepharshim. And also, even the Som Tasim Alecha Melech, you should establish a king on yourself. The one understanding is it's a mitzvah, but there's another understanding. Rav Sadia Gaon says that you have the Torah is telling you you're allowed to. Not that you have a mitzvah to establish a king. Many Rishonim say you have a mitzvah to establish a king. But Rav Sadia Gaon says, no. The Torah is saying you'll come. You'll say, I want a king like all the nations. So you should know you could establish a king, but not that we have a special mitzvah to establish a king. It's interesting then, the prohibition of rebelling against the king. So some say the king has a mitzvah. Kill whoever rebels against you. And some say, and the Lashon in the Rambam seems to indicate this way, there's no prohibition to rebel against the king. Nowhere in the Torah does it say you can't rebel against the king. It says you're supposed to honor a king. Special mitzvot say you have to fear a king. But if you rebelled against him, did you transgress? So it doesn't say clearly you're not allowed to rebel. It says, if someone rebels, then the king could kill them. But are you allowed to rebel? So some want to say you're allowed to rebel. The Torah says we establish a king, and the king has special mitzvot. He's not allowed to have too many horses. He's allowed to have as many horses as he needs. If he has one horse that's just idle, then he's transgressed. King is allowed to have a lot of wives, but we derive from King David, from David the Mech, he's limited to 18. Let's say he has 18 and he wants a 19th, so he could divorce one and marry another one. He's allowed to do that. King David didn't do that because he didn't want to hurt their feelings. He was limited, and here we see the greatness of David the Melech, that he was at a period in life where a lot of his women were forbidden. His son had raped many of his wives, and therefore he could not take them back in. And he didn't divorce them. He maintained their honor, and he didn't hurt their feelings, because he was limited to 18 wives. He had filled his 18. He needed another wife to keep him warm, right? He was at an old age, and the doctors told him, you need another wife. If you take a wife who's a virgin, she's the cure. How that works, we don't know, but the doctors there knew because the Torah says, the Tanakh says it worked. So he never married her. He couldn't marry her. He could have married her and divorced one of his other wives, but he said, I can't hurt their feelings. So he preferred to be in an embarrassing situation where he had to be in hiding. We find that from that point then on in his lifetime, he was barely seen in public. But rather than hurt his wife's feelings, even though many of them he could never live with again, and he just sustained them, and he could have kept that same sustenance, given them the same stipend, and helped them out the same way he did from that point on, and divorced them. But no, he didn't do that. He knew that it would hurt their feelings. So he preferred to take on himself this difficult situation of being with a girl and not marrying her, rather than hurt his wife's feelings. So a king is limited in how many wives he can have, and he's not allowed to have too much gold and silver. He's allowed to have storage houses for the need of the people and have gold and silver, but he's not allowed to amass it out of his own pride. Now, over here, the Torah says he should not have too many horses. Hashem told you he shouldn't go back to Egypt. And Egypt is a source of sources. We don't want him bringing the people back to Egypt. Now, it would seem like the Torah is giving us the reason to this mitzvah. Just like the Torah says he shouldn't have too many wives, they shouldn't cause him to err. They shouldn't confuse him. He shouldn't have too much money. He has to remain humble. Three mitzvahs the Torah gave to a king, and three mitzvahs the Torah told us why. And those three mitzvahs, King Solomon, who was the wisest person, said, I am a very, very wise person. God gave me extra understanding. I know the reason behind these mitzvot. I'll maintain the reason without maintaining the mitzvot. And he erred on all of them. God caused him to err. So, I shouldn't say on all of them. He erred on the one with wives. So, our sages say, from here we see the importance of what the Torah did for us. The Torah hid the reasons of the mitzvot. Every mitzvah has a good reason. Every mitzvah is there with a good logical reason, which one day God will give us the reasons and explain to us why. But God didn't reveal it to us as a favor to us. Because when we understand the reasons, then we'll think, hey, I know the reason. I'll maintain the reason, but I could not perform this mitzvah. And we see that even Shlomo, the wisest person, couldn't live up to that. The Torah is smarter than we are. We're just a little hard at understanding that the Torah is smarter than we are. And we find that even in rabbinic decrees, when our sages instituted a rabbinic decree, first they'd give out the decree without giving the reason. For at least a year, when they instituted a decree, the decree would be instituted without giving the reason why. After people accepted the decree, then they'd start teaching the reason why. The same concept. When people hear a reason, they say, I can do it. You tell me I shouldn't touch a light. I'll touch it, I just won't turn it on. You say I shouldn't touch a pencil, I won't write on Shabbos. I'll just carry a pen in my pocket. Or say, just say, no, Mokhtza, you can't carry a pen. We know better. The Torah tells us the king shouldn't have too many horses. He shouldn't bring us back to Mitzrayim. Hashem says, don't go back to Mitzrayim. So the Rambam paskins in Halacha, you're not allowed to live in Mitzrayim. Right? Like the Gemara says, the Rambam, it's Halacha. Oh, excellent question. That's where we're headed. The Rambam himself, let's see, we'll get to that. So the halacha is that one is allowed to go do business in Mitzrayim, but one is not allowed to go live in Mitzrayim. The Rambam himself lived in Mitzrayim, famous question. So there are two answers that I know of that are offered by the Rishonim. One is that it says you're not allowed to live in the land of Mitzrayim. And very often we've raised the question, when we say Eretz Mitzrayim, what does the word mean? Does it mean the land, that the land has a name Mitzrayim? Or does it mean the land where the people of Mitzrayim live? When we say Eretz Yisrael, is the land known as Eretz Yisrael? Or is it the land that the people of Israel live in? Is it the land that's owned by the people of Israel? What does the term mean when we say it's Eretz so-and-so? Does that mean that area geographically has that name? Or does it mean the piece of land that's owned by that people or that's inhabited by that people? It's fair to say that when we say the land of Mitzrayim, we mean the land where the people of Mitzrayim live. There's no prohibition of a specific geographic area. We have a tradition. The Pasuk says that King Sancheiriv testified about himself, V'asil gvulot amim v'atidotehem shoseiti. I took apart all the boundaries of nations, I conquered much of the world, and every nation that Sancheiriv would conquer, he'd take them, move them to another land. They'd be all confused till they could figure out how to make a livelihood, till they could figure out what they're doing. They wouldn't rebel. They were exiled people. Go do something. You can't do much when you're in exile. You don't know the land. You don't know the agriculture. You have to figure out how to make a living. You're not going to rebel. It worked. But what Sancheiriv did was he mixed up the whole world. Ever since Sancheiriv was around, so we said there's no such thing as a nation of Ammon, there's no such thing as a nation of Moab, There's no such thing as nation of Amalek. What about the nation of Mitzrayim? So there are two opinions in Tosfos, whether this applies to the nation of Mitzrayim. Because it says that Mitzrayim fought Sancheiriv and lost the war, so they retreated into their land. Doesn't seem like he conquered them. It says that the nation of Mitzrayim could no longer use their military might to leave the land of Mitzrayim. So there are two opinions in Tosfos. The Tosefta seems to indicate that even Mitzri, there are no longer Mitzrim, that the Mitzrim were also scattered. Because the Tosefta discusses that there was one of the disciples who was a Ger Mitzri, and he wanted to marry into the Jewish people. He said, I'll marry a Ger, my son will marry a second generation Ger, and my grandson will already be able to marry into the Jewish people. And he was told, no, no problem, you can marry in now. So again, this was during the period of these arguments between Rabbi Yeshua and Rabbi Gamliel. Rabbi Yeshua said, you could. Rabbi Gamliel says, what do you mean? Rabbi Yeshua told him, no such thing as Mitzri anymore, no such thing as Ammon, Moav. Doesn't exist. Ever since Sancheriv, the end of the first temple, no such thing. So it seems like this applies to Mitzrayim as well. But it's unclear. So they want to say, one answer is that no such thing as Mitzrayim, or no such thing as the Mitzri people. So even though geographically we know where the land of Mitzrayim is, that's no longer known halachically as the land of Mitzrayim. If we identify the land of Mitzrayim as the land where the people of Mitzrayim live, well, there are no people of Mitzrayim there. And this opinion has great support in the Rambam, because when the Rambam records the halacha not to live in Mitzrayim, the Rambam says, I think, says the Rambam, that if a Jewish king would conquer the land of Mitzrayim the way he should with a Beis Din, then I think, says the Rambam, that it would be permissible to live in the land of Mitzrayim. The Torah forbade individuals to go back and live in the land of Mitzrayim, or to live there when it's in the hand of non-Jews. Why, says the Rambam? Because the actions of the Mitzri people are more decrepit than any other land, as the Torah itself says, Nachremos or Kedoshim, Nachremos, K'maasei Eretz Mitzrayim. The Torah says, don't do like the Mitzrim. The Torah has a special prohibition, don't be like the Mitzrim. So the Rambam says, it seems to me like that's the reason why. So that's why this understanding has great support. If the land of Mitzrayim, we know the Rambam rules that there are no longer any Mitzrim in the world. The Rambam rules this elsewhere, that there is no concept of Mitzri, so then this isn't the land of Mitzrayim. So maybe that's why the Rambam allowed himself to live in the land of Mitzrayim. Another understanding is that the prohibition to live in the land of Mitzrayim was only when the Jews were in the land of Israel. When we were in the land of Israel, there was a prohibition to live in the land of Mitzrayim. And during the Rambam's time, we weren't in the land of Israel. We didn't have sovereignty in the land of Israel. This understanding is problematic, because the Rambam doesn't seem to rule this way. There is a quote that they say that the Rambam used to sign his name and say that every day he transgresses three biblical commandments, and one of them was not to live in the land of Egypt. That's what they quote. I once saw it inside, but who knows? Okay. We said that the Rambam said you have to conquer it the way the Halacha says. The way the Halacha says is there has to be a high court of Sanhedrin. We have to have conquered all the land of Israel we're supposed to conquer, but I don't want to go into all that now. So that's why today, even if we conquer Egypt, this isn't relevant yet. It seems that when the Torah discusses Mitzrayim, the Torah attributes to the Mitzrim adultery and not idolatry. Even though the Torah does discuss that they served idols, when the Torah says not to do like the Mitzrim, the Torah mentions it about lesbian women, and the Torah mentions it about immoral activities between men and women. It seems that when we say that the Mitzrim, also the prophets, when they described the immoral acts of the Mitzrim, they said, "Shabsar hamorim saram bezirmat susim zirmatam." They stressed their activities when it came to incest and immoral activities between men and women. Even though we do know that there was a lot of kishuf there and magic and idol worship, it seems that the stress was that aspect. And that, I don't know if it changed. I don't know.
Wasn't Rabbi Yosef chief rabbi in Egypt?
Could be. Could be. He was born there. You see, he left. I don't know. Okay. The Torah limits the king. And the Torah says he has to be especially modest. And he has to have his own Sefer Torah, which he keeps in his right hand. He'd probably write a small Sefer Torah and keep it like tefillin. The Pasuk says, Shiviti Hashem le-negdi tamid. Davram says, what's the end of the Pasuk? Ki mi mini, because on my right, Balemot doesn't leave. What doesn't leave? A Sefer Torah. David always had a Sefer Torah on his right hand. The king would wear a Sefer Torah like a tefillin. Like we wear a tefillin, the king would have Sefer Torah by his right. He has a mitzvah to always have Sefer Torah with him. He has a special mitzvah to write it. It says, Milifnei Kohanim Alviim. So from here our sages say that he has to write the Sefer Torah from a special Sefer Torah they had in Azara. Mishnah sometimes speak about Sefer Torah Ba'azara. There was a special Sefer Torah that was like the Tikkun Korim. That off that Sefer Torah, they checked that all the other Sefer Torah were right. That was Sefer Ha'azara, the Sefer Torah that was in the Azara. It was supposed to be especially accurate. That's what the Mishnah says in Moed Katan. If you find a mistake in the Sefer Torah, even Sefer Torah Sheba'azara, even the Sefer Torah in the Azara, so wait, fix it after Chol Moed. Don't write on Chol Moed. The Torah says he'll be a king that won't be haughty, so he'll have a long kingdom, him and his sons. From here we derive that ideally a person's son should be king after him, and this applies not only to a king, but any position of leadership in the Jewish people. Be it a chazan, be it a gabbai, all these things, halachically we say a person collects tzedakah. His son has first rights if he's fitting to be after him the one that collects. We've run out of time, so we're going to try to quickly mention a few points, then we'll have to end. The Torah says that Kohanim get special portions from each animal. And this doesn't apply to sacrifice. This applies specifically to chulin, to animals that are non-sacrifices. They are the zra lechayim v'keva, the cheek with the tongue, the front right foot, the bottom part from like the joint that would be the equivalent of the knee and down, and part of the stomach. The Torah trains us that the first things we give to Kohanim, we give to Hashem. This is to train us in being giving people and to calm our lusts. We always try to get our pleasures and attain our wealth. And the Torah tries to train us that everything we do should be for Hashem and to calm ourselves down a little bit. The cheek, that's the first part that's ready for eating. The front right foot is the part that walks forward first. The stomach, that's the first part of the innards of the animal. We give that all to the kohen. Again, the same concept of firsts. These things are relevant in Chutz Arts as well. So why don't we do it today? So we'll get back then in a second. It's unclear why we don't do it today. Really, if we read the dry halacha, it seems like we should do it today. Torah says we have to give the first shearings of the animals to the kohen. And this applies only in the land of Israel, the first shearing of the sheep, Reshit HaGez. Now, that applies only in the land of Israel. There's a Gemara in Brachos, that the Gemara enumerates things that we have accustomed to go this way, and that's the halacha. And it seems like the dry halacha shouldn't be this way, but the nation adopted this way, so that's the halacha. One is, a person who saw Keri, some semen, sperm emitted from him, he doesn't have to go to mikveh in order to learn Torah and Davin. So that's the halacha. It's the halacha. Another one's Reshis HaGez. So we don't give Reshis HaGez now in Chutz Arts. It's unclear why we don't give it in the land of Israel. Rashi quotes, there's a Gemara in Shabbos that records there was an Amara walking around with Zra Lechayim, Keva, he had these gifts, and he says, whoever tells me another quote from my Rebbe, Rabbi Bar Bachana, I'll give him these special gifts that I was given. So Rashi says, wait a second, this is the time of the Gemara. If they were giving it in the time of the Gemara, after the destruction of the temple, why don't we give it today? So Rashi says, in those times, they didn't yet adopt this minute. Now, just like we don't give Reishis HaGez, we don't give this either. But that's a special chiddush of Rashi's. Ordinarily, it would seem, why shouldn't we give it today? So Rashi says, the Gemara says, we accepted this custom. So he says, look around. You see anyone giving these? Must be we accepted this custom also about this. What's the problem with Rashi? So who am I to say there's a problem? But others say that we don't find this opinion about these gifts. this opinion said about that? How does Rashi apply it to this? So Rashi says, okay, we accepted this opinion, but where do we find that this opinion applied to these parts of the meat we're supposed to give the coin? So you could look, the Aruch HaShulchan has a piece on this where he also asks, why don't we do a lot of this? The same question should be asked about the gifts Tanim here in Eretz Yisrael. Why don't we give Leket Shikhan Peya? So that's a good question. The Aruch HaShulchan speaks about it. Also, he asks, why don't we do it?
Why don't we do what?
The gifts to the Anim. If you drop a piece of wheat, if you forget a bundle, the corners of the field, why don't we give them that? The Torah says we shouldn't go to all these sorcerers. So there's a big machlokas rishonim. The Ramban says it's natural. Everyone wants to know what's going to be in the future. But Hashem says, go to the Navi, don't go to these people. Rav Saadia Gaon, quoted by the Radak in Sefer Shmuel, says that these people were fakes. These were fakes. They didn't really know how to tell the future. They could, what's it called? A person knows how to throw his voice. They could project their voice. What's it called? Ventriloquist, right.
Yeah.
They knew ventriloquism. So the Radak quotes this opinion from the period of the Gaonim. I don't remember if it's Rav Saadia or Rav Shira Gaon. That there was no truth to this. They knew how to play games. The Ramban seems to say that they did. They did know how to tell the future. They just couldn't be accurate. That's why we say if a Navi's off even by a little bit, he gets killed because he's lying. But the Gemara records different ways that they do it. They take different bones from dead people, from dead either dead birds is one understanding, a specific dead bird, or Yadua. It says a Yidoni is they take a bone from a Yadua. What's a Yadua? It says a Yadua, a bird, is it some type of wild animal? Is it an orangutan? Is it an animal that has an umbilical cord attached to the ground? It's unclear. They could hear voices from under their armpits. Are these really voices that came from underground? They would offer all kinds of incense, and then they could throw rocks at a piece of hide and then get all kinds of air. They take a hadas branch, swirl it around, and they could blind the person and then make him hear all kinds of things. Did these things really work? Or did they know all kinds of plants and make people hallucinate how it worked? So that there are different opinions among the Rishonim, whether they really could tell things from the future or not. At any rate, we have a mitzvah not to listen to them. There's a serious problem. People today call the radio. They have radio shows today, and they say all kinds of things. I see in your future, tomorrow's going to be very good for this. I see you're entering a period of time where, aside from the fact that they're fakes, I told you, I was a magician as a kid. I read books on this. It's all garbage. I'm telling you, it's garbage. When I was a kid, I didn't know this was forbidden. I learned all this. It's garbage. I know how to do it too. All the things you tell a person, the things that's going to be in his future, all these fortune tellers today, I've read tons of books on fortune telling. It's garbage. They're fakers. I could also tell you a lot of things about yourself and your future. And I'll be right. And you can walk around and say all kinds of things about me. But don't, because it's all nonsense. But even if they were telling the truth, the Torah says you're not allowed to do this. You're not allowed to go to a meonin. What's a meonin? Someone who tells you this period of time is good for this, this period of time is good for that. You're not allowed to do that. People have a tendency, they want someone to take control of their lives. So it's very easy to go to someone that we don't understand him, because then maybe he understands what's going on in this world. Paul says the Torah, you're not allowed to go to him. You want to say he knows what he's talking about? Good. You want to say he doesn't know what he's talking about? Even better. Bottom line, you're not allowed to go to him. The Torah says, Tamim tiyem Hashem lokecha, be whole, be complete with Hashem your God. This is a pasuk. This is a mitzvah. We have to behold Hashem, believe that Hashem's running the show. He can make good things bad, bad things good. He's running the show. He's the one we should daven for. It's interesting that we're coming up. We entered the month of Elul. We have to do tshuva. People are looking for all kinds of things, easy way outs. This segula or that segula. A woman can't get pregnant, so they go to every kever that there could be. A person can't find the shidduch. He goes to every rabbi to give him a blessing. The Torah tells us we have to be complete with Hashem. It's important to get a blessing. It's a good thing to dominate a kever. But we have to know that we have to fix ourselves. We have to be complete with Hashem. That's the bottom line. And the Ramah quotes this pasuk a few times in Shulchan Aruch, by the halachas of Monin and Mechashev, and also in the halachas of Sukkos. We have a tradition that if a person goes up to the rooftop on Hoshana Rabbah by night, naked, and he looks at his shadow, he'll be able to tell if he's going to live the year out. Either if he sees his shadow upside down, or if he sees a limb missing from his shadow, then he knows that he won't live out the year. And if he doesn't, if his whole shadow is complete and normal, he'll be okay. Says the Ramah, don't do it. Tamim tiyem Hashem okecha. Don't try to figure out the future. Be whole with Hashem your God. So the Ramah quotes this in a few places. He quotes over there in Hilchos Sukkos, in Yerdeh, in Hilchos Monin and Mechashev. Person should be whole with Hashem. What are you trying to figure out the future? Make the future good. Do tshuva. Daven to Hashem. Learn Torah. We're entering the month of Elul. Elul is Rashi Tevos. Ani ledodi vedodi li. I am for my beloved and my beloved is for me. We have two periods of time in the year. We have the period of Nisan and the period of Elul. The time of Nisan is the time that Hashem appeared to the Jewish people. He came close to us. We weren't fit to be redeemed from Egypt. We were all sinning. We were serving idols. The angels up in heaven said, what's the difference? Why are you killing the Mitzvah, not the Jews? They're no better. God said, keep quiet. I see the difference. But angels couldn't see the difference. We were so bad. So that's the month of Elul. Dodi li, my beloved is for me. Hashem came to us. Hashem took the first step. That's Nisan. Vanilo. And then we follow. Hashem came to us. The month of Elul, we got to take the first step. That's Ani le dodi, I am for my beloved, v'dodi li. And then Hashem will come towards us. Ani le dodi, v'dodi li, each word ends with a yud. We have four words that ends with a yud. Four times yud, yud is 10, is 40. We have 40 days from Rosh Chodesh Elul to Yom Kippur. These 40 days, it says, Birshu Hashem v'imatzo, seek out Hashem when He is found. This is the time that we have an extra help from up in heaven to do tshuva. Every person should know there's a springboard waiting. We could jump forward. Every person should take time during the day. Tonight we're starting the month of Elul. People should take time during the day and think about where they were, where they're headed, and how they're going to get there. If people don't take notes, so we just had 3 weeks that went by. Ask yourself what you did in these 3 weeks. It's been asman. Where'd you move? Where could you have been? And where are you at the end of 3 weeks? Hopefully you have positive things to report back. More than likely, people don't factor in what's been going on, and the 3 weeks went through their fingertips, and they don't have much to show for them. That's what most people's main asmanim looks like. So at the end of the 3 weeks, a person should ask himself, how did that happen? Most of the time what happens is people don't notice. This is a time a person should take notice. The ancient custom was to wake up early in the morning. For us, I don't think that's a good idea. Guys are going to sleep late, better get a good night's sleep, but take time during the day to ask yourself, where are you going and how are you going to get there? This is a time that we say in heaven, they give extra help for people to move forward, to do tshuva. Every person should, in this time, try and move forward. May we merit to approach Rosh Hashanah with happiness and move forward this month. We should know not to wallow in the past, learn from the past, and focus on making the future better. The point of this is not to sit and think of the past and become depressed. The point is to learn from the past in order to build the future. So it has to be a positive experience. Part of tshuva, Rav Kook wrote a special compilation about tshuva, and the concept of tshuva is to come back. We're coming back to our natural self, coming back to the way we should be, and we should be happy about it. Obviously, part of tshuva is also regretting the past. That's elementary, but not to soak and wallow in misery. Yeah. Okay.
It's the whole month.
It's the month plus the 10 days, the first 10 days of the month of Tishrei, up to Yom Kippur, 40 days. But let's get a head start. We're starting tonight. Let's move forward.